He wanted me to put my profile on escort websites, and I would, you know, see the guys, and then I would give him the money. And that's what he'd been doing for a very long time. So we were in Miami and I was working, and then I had to renew my visa. So I convinced him to let me come back to Sydney. I went to the embassy, they denied my visa, and they came back with an AFP officer and a special agent from the FBI in America. I told them the whole story. Just like a little bit before Christmas, I got a message from them saying they'd arrested him in New York. They said, like, we need you to fly over there and testify. So he got convicted, 27 years, 40 charges. I could not let that happen to me and then let that be my story. That's the girl that got trafficked. And I just thought, oh, my God, what kind of story is that going to be if I don't heal through this? I wanted to have my business always. And I started off very much like, I need to go and help all the women in the world. Naturally, when you come out of that, you just kind of want to help. I started to create a brand that I'm really proud of. I chose lingerie, obviously, to connect with my sexuality again in a positive way, and to connect with my feminine, because when you go through a lot of trauma, you disconnect from that feminine part of you. And this product, being lingerie, I want it to liberate women from whatever it is that is holding them back.
Kay, how are you going?
Good, thanks, Brad.
You've made all the way down from the Gold Coast. How was the trip?
Yes, nice early morning for me, but that's okay. Made it here.
Yeah, got back to Sydney.
Yes, back in my old hood.
Your old stomping ground.
Yep.
Sydney side. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Rosebery. I went to school in Darlinghurst. Yeah. And, spent a lot of time around like the eastern suburbs. Yeah. So, yeah, love coming back here.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that when you're from here. But today's going to be a really cool conversation. I'm sure we'll go down lots of different rabbit holes. You have such a interesting story. For some, this might be, you know, there's some traumatic aspects of this. There are some really proud, brave, powerful components of this as well. And I'm excited to go everywhere if you're okay with that. And, you know, it was really cool because Taryn, who you work with, Taryn Williams, for many of our guests would have listened to her episode a little while back, but connected us up and said she was so inspired by what you're doing in business with Vixen and Fox, but also everything you're about. So let's see where we go.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So, look, I'm going to start, you know, by saying I see you as a real outperformer. I've heard your story, 60 Minutes. I've heard your story in just another podcast. You know, you're kind of getting out there in different ways. But there were moments of it that brought tears to my eyes. And I was literally, today I was like concerned about my own emotional state. and anyone who would have read the, you know, we put show notes out. You click on the podcast, they'll probably see a bit about your story as well before they even hear this. But tell us who Kay is, and when we think about the entrepreneur that you're becoming, we'll weave in all the connective tissue over the time we talk, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's always a hard question because, you know, you don't want to answer with, you know, I'm the founder of Vixen and Fox or whatever. You want to go a little bit deeper, but a lot of my, you know, identity is made up in my brand, and it's really been a big part of my healing and getting me to where I am today. So I am the founder and creative director of Vixen and Fox. Vixen and Fox is a luxury lingerie brand.
It's the early days.
Yeah, it's early days. I feel like I've been doing it forever, and it has been a lot of years in the design and development phase, and I'd say learning phase, really. I feel like I've done a degree. I have no fashion background. I feel like I've done a degree in pattern making and manufacturing and logistics and all sorts of things. And I think as much as I look back and think it was painful because I felt so out of my depth, like I still feel that like now, but not as much. I think I liked it. And I think, yeah, I've always wanted to have my own business. And every time I've worked for someone, I've always felt like this need to like get out of that job. You know, I did work under Bradley Michael for many years. He's the owner of the Seagrass Group. And I loved working with him because I was watching him be an entrepreneur, an incredible entrepreneur. So I look back and I think, you know, why did I stay so long in hospitality? Like wasn't my passion, but it was him and being able to watch him grow his brands and the way he treated his staff. I mean, he's got staff working with him, you know, 20 years ago, they're still working with him. I go into the restaurants and I used to work with them when I was like 20. Mm. So, and I'm just like, that's incredible, incredible leadership. So I think I just gravitated to him and, yeah.
Mm. And for those who aren't familiar with Seagrass, it's Meat and Wine Co., right?
That's Meat and Wine Co., Six Head, Ribs and Burgers. I mean, I started with him when he had one restaurant in Darling Harbour. I just went past it actually on the way here. It was in the old IMAX. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was my first like job out of, not my first job out of school, but hospitality. I just took a cashier's job. I'll just take a cashier's job and I'll just do that for a little bit while I figure my life out. And then, he gave me the autonomy to try new things. He gave me targets and I just grew with him. And like by 21, I was the brand manager of Meat and Wine Co. So I was just, really grateful for him giving me that freedom to try different things. And I was lucky enough to, you know, for me to meet him coming out of school, because that really, I guess, paved the way to me wanting to have my own business one day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I never really got caught up in the day-to-day things of running the restaurant. Like I was always looking at, like, how do you build a team? Mm-hmm. How do you put processes and procedures in place? How do you do that so that you can open 8 stores and you've got this consistency across 8? That was always, you know, within me from like a young age. So I don't know if he brought that out in me, like if it was already there, or maybe he just like woke that up inside of me. And then, I'd always get bored. It's funny, like, you know, I'd be in a role for like a year or I'd open a restaurant and manage it. And then I'd be like, I'm bored. And he's like, okay, what do you want to do now? And he'd create roles for me.
Or open another restaurant for you or something.
Yeah, it's like different roles. Like I went into, he created a role for me, inbound and reservations manager, where I would go out and meet inbound groups and kind of fill the quiet time. So, you know, I went from cashier to being like reservation manager. We were working with a paper diary at Darling Harbour, like the only restaurant there, working with a paper diary still. And I got rid of it, got us onto a reservation system. And then I just wanted to fill seats, like, and I'm talking like from when the restaurant was open. So between 4 and 6, it was super quiet. And I had the idea of reaching out to tour groups and getting them to come in, and 1 hour you can get like 100 people in and out, you know, give them a bread roll, salad, one main, ice cream, they're out. And that's what they wanted and that's what we wanted. So, you know, you'd maybe do $3,000 to $5,000 in an hour. So I started doing that, and then, yeah, and then I went into the brand management because I just loved the brand so much, and I wanted to help him get that consistency, because I go to open different restaurants and then it always bugged me when one restaurant was doing it one way and another restaurant was doing it another. Mm-hmm. So when I went into the brand manager position, I got, I guess, the ability to bring consistency. And I don't know, for some reason it's like very satisfying watching consistency happen across restaurants that were not even in the same city or suburb. Mm. I don't know why, but always love that.
That might be the entrepreneur in you.
Possibly. Possibly, yeah.
Well, it's interesting what you say, because, you know, entrepreneurs are always working it out, but it sounds like you've got a natural tendency to problem solve, right? So we'll dig into that. And you also made reference to healing, which we'll dig into as well, because mm-hmm. there's a bit of that in your journey. But I wonder, right, so you've had that opportunity to be part of a growth journey, to see that, to be contributing to that. You've also got to stage now with Vixen and Fox, which we can talk about, where you've attracted some really experienced, talented people to be part of your advisory group, to be part of designing the future and really making some great headway. Can you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about why you think those people have jumped on and trusted to work with you?
Yeah. Well, I guess if I think back, the whole way through my journey, I've been wanting to align with people that know more than me. Mm. And I guess I aligned with the right people at the right time. Even I look back now and think they didn't help me very much. I spent a lot of money and I didn't really feel like I got anywhere. But I feel like the more I worked on myself, the more I went through my healing and reflected on my energy, what I was putting out, you start to notice like a direct correlation between how you're feeling and the people you're attracting. And it's very confronting because you realize, and I can see it now because it's been years and I've looked at my energy at one point and looked at the people I attracted at that point. Now I look at my energy now and I look at the people I'm attracting now. So it's exciting when you see that and you realize you have the power to attract, you know, people into your life and opportunities. So yeah, I guess I went through a phase of, you know, kind of going from consultant to consultant. I was working with freelancers who were giving me advice, like kind of within maybe a designer was giving me advice about production and a pattern maker was helping me with something. So it was always kind of like that. And then the first time I got a coach for a long period of time was at the beginning of last year. I worked with a lady, Elizabeth Formosa from Fashion Equipped, and she's really high level strategy. So she, again, we were putting money into ads, we kind of weren't seeing the result. I also wasn't happy with the, I guess, I felt like I had a lot to talk about with my story and the brand and I didn't know how to bring it all together. And I was just too close to the brand to kind of work through it. And it was becoming very overwhelming for me actually, because I'm like, I know this story has to be included in the brand. I can't just forget about that as the reason that the brand started. So Elizabeth really helped me over the last year to, get some consistency with the messaging and understand what it is that I want to say. So we redesigned the whole website and, you know, worked on our socials and just, yes, had consistency across all our channels. I was planning on just kind of going on podcasts like this, going out and gifting and doing certain things. And then, Taryn and I crossed paths. I mean, we'd been talking on email occasionally about different things. You know, I really admire her. So I'd reached out a few times and said, congrats on this or whatever. So, I also used The Right Fit, which she was, founder of. So I, we crossed paths and then I shared some things about the brand and then she was like, oh, well, you know, maybe, myself and my mate Josh can help. And Josh is like the ex-CEO of Sass & Bide. So I was like, yes.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? And I was just like, at first I was like, oh, am I like just jumping from one person to the next here? I wanted some time to kind of process what I'd done with Elizabeth. So I sat on it for like 2 weeks and I thought, no, like I need to go with my gut here. I want it to be a global brand. I'm not trying to do something small here, and I'm still doing everything, you know, Elizabeth has suggested, which is absolutely right, like gifting, going on podcasts, getting out there. But what I was like kind of concerned about is, okay, something takes off, there's all that production side to think about, when to order things, how to deal with these sales agents, how to deal with media, all this kind of stuff. And Taryn being like, you know, the weapon she is with influencer marketing and PR and things like that. And Josh kind of knowing how to manage a brand and just, you know, I mean, he worked with Tom Brown, worth millions of dollars type of thing. So I just wanted someone that had way more experience than me that could kind of just simplify it, because it's super overwhelming to think, okay, like it's like the chicken or the egg like situation with everything. Like, okay, I'll go on podcasts and then, okay, well, what happens then? You get a really great opportunity, but you can't fulfill orders. So it's like a real balancing act that you absolutely need someone by your side that can be like, it's okay. Like, can't. It's all right. let's take one step at a time.
Well, in all fairness, and every single entrepreneur we've had on this podcast, everyone I've worked with, those overwhelming moments happen a lot, right? And these are new areas, and having those types of people around you, they sharpen your focus, they get you pulling in a good direction. And one of the things that we talked about offline was that you've shifted very deliberately to a wholesale model, right? Now, that in itself, from a brand perspective, is a really, you know, smart thing to do, because it ultimately allows you to touch more people through a different audience and a very different model of service. But what did you learn from Taryn and Josh that sort of resulted in that decision?
I went to Sydney and had a workshop with them both, and we just kind of sat for a whole day and just kind of worked through what we already have and where we're going. And Josh, with like all the experience that he's got, he just kind of looked at and went, you need to go wholesale. He even said, like, you need to have your own flagship store, like, soon, you know. And like most other people would tell you, like, don't do that. That's crazy. And even for me, I'm like, coming out of COVID, I'm like, online is the way to go. Like, absolutely. Everyone's shopping online now. People know how to figure out sizing. There's good return policies. So we'll just go hard with paid ads. And yeah, he just kind of flipped it back. And of course, I'm going to listen to him. I was like, okay, well, yeah, if you want to like kind of be by my side, like I'm happy to go hard with that and talk to sales agents and get out there and talk to boutiques. And so that's the direction that we're going to go now.
Yeah, very good. And you're very much a luxury brand.
Yes, we are a luxury brand, and the price point is higher, but the quality is also there as well. Lingerie is typically a harder thing to buy online. So, you know, and it does deserve to be in a store. It does deserve someone to see it and touch it and try it on. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was talking before, we were chatting about my challenges with buying lingerie.
Yeah.
I have tried before. My wife has, we've had various different experiences with what's works and what's a good choice. And, you know, poor old Brad's not very good at it, but, but I do my best. But the thing I do notice about this industry that you're playing in is that there's a certain experience that comes with, you know, getting something that fits and that's right and that feels good. And I'm no woman, obviously, but I'm trying my best to always sit on the other side of the fence and understand that. What have you learned about that as you've explored this industry?
The experience, like buying lingerie?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sizing has been one of the biggest challenges in this brand, like, and building this brand. It's not a exact science, and it depends what fabrics you use. It, you know, it depends on how you sew it. So we've been trying to, me wanting to get everything perfect, it's just like, it's next to impossible to get your sizing the same as another brand. So even if you are a size in another brand, it's probably not likely that you're exactly the same size in, you know, our brand, for example. So we also do a different kind of sizing adjustment on the back of the bras, which is unique. I mean, it's not really unique in Europe and UK. A lot of people do it now to allow for extra adjustability and also have a better aesthetic on the back, so you can wear it as like outerwear. That's kind of becoming a thing now. So yeah, being able to, I guess, communicate the whole sizing experience online has been like a little bit harder for us. That's again a big reason why we need to get into boutiques, get people to know their size, and you also have professional fitters there as well. So yeah, but it's really important. I mean, we deliver it in a beautiful gifted box and a beautiful satin bag. So the experience of buying online is really nice as well. We've tried to make it like that. Everything's been thought out, very intentional to give you that like luxury experience. But yeah, I mean, in store would be just as good.
Yeah, the pivoting moment. Yeah. Well, it's exciting times.
Yeah.
It is. It's a, you know, it's interesting because if I reflect back on your story, and I want to, there's been pivots as well. There's all these pivots you talked about healing before. Maybe you can contextualize your story around the why of this brand, because there's a lot around what you're trying to bring to life around your brand that's in your story.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can share a bit more about that.
Yeah. So I guess I always wanted to have a business. I didn't know what that would be. I went through lots of different things through my 20s trying to figure out what that might be. When I was in Gold Coast working for Brad, opening a restaurant there, I was meant to open a restaurant in Brisbane, a meat and wine co, but never opened. So at that point, I'd been with him for like maybe 5-6 years. So I thought, oh, maybe it's time to go to uni maybe, and I'll do a business degree. So I went to Bond University and started my business degree. And, you know, coming from the background that I came from, you know, I went to a private school in Sydney and I kind of didn't go without growing up. But emotionally, I wasn't in a stable environment, and that was hard. I felt like always quite a sensitive child. You know, there's, you know, my brothers, I'm sure it affected them too. But for me, I was just like, oh, like, what's happening? Like, I can see my parents unhappy, and but they still go to work every day and still provide for us. So it was like a bit of a, you know, a bit hard to understand that. So I, you know, I naturally wanted to go into like psychology or do something like that. Yeah. As you do, you know, you start to want to understand what's going on in life, how people think and their behavior.
I can understand that. Yeah.
So I was kind of like, even before my business degree, I think I had started like a psychology thing, and then that didn't stick. Because I wanted to have my own business, and I'm like, how can I use this? Like, that's great that I'm going to study psychology. I didn't realize I could just go onto YouTube.
Well, back then it might have been a bit harder because there wasn't as much information around. So the world has changed a little bit, but yeah.
I think so. Thanks, Brad. Yeah. I think that's the case because I'm like, I could have just studied it. I think that's what I was craving. I was just wanting to understand myself more and other people. So I was doing the business degree, and then I thought I'll go to Lifeline, like telephone counseling, and, you know, do that for a little bit and see if there's like, I don't know, maybe I'm going to have a call with somebody I'm going to be like, oh, you know, I want to help kids or I want to help women or something. So I was doing that on the side, and I was just waitressing. And doing all of that. And I'm kind of going back in my story before Vixen and Fox. I'm getting to the why. So I was kind of like still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And then at that point, look, I mean, I was doing fairly well. I was 21 and I'd worked for Brad and doing good. I did well with his company. I bought my own apartment I was 20. Yeah. Not bad when I look back now, I think, you know, and I, you know, I was thinking, wow, if this is how I'm when I'm 20, imagine where I'm going to be later on in life. So I was always striving, like always wanted to like tick the boxes, and, it was like, go to uni, buy a house, buy a nice car, went to the Gold Coast, like living in a like 3-bedroom house. Like it was good. Like, and I was like, felt like I was succeeding. And so then I'm at uni, trying to figure out what I want to do. And at that time when I was waitressing, I was working at the restaurant, and my manager, he asked if I wanted to go to a club that was across the road, like just a nightclub. There was like a themed night there. And I don't usually, like, I wasn't going out. I mean, I was working 60 hours at the restaurant and doing Lifeline and Bond University. So I wasn't going out that much. And I was like, okay, like I had housemates at that time. I'd finally got housemates. I stopped living the luxury life, 3 bedrooms by myself.
Yeah, it helps the rent a little bit. Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, I've done that for 6 months. Like, I'll get somebody in. So I got a couple of girls in, I invited one of those, and we went to the nightclub. And at the nightclub, I met somebody, and we just hit it off straight away. It was a guy, and he was, you know, here from the States, and he wanted to open Latin Caribbean restaurants in the Gold Coast and like all over Australia. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really crazy. Like I, you know, been in the restaurant game for like the last, you know, 5 years.
So an instant connection.
Instant connection. Very charismatic, from New York, so big energy. And I found him attractive too. And so, but at that time, I just come out of a 3-year relationship, and I wasn't looking for a relationship, but I'm very business like minded. So I was like, I can talk business. Like, yeah. So, you know, we kind of hit it off. And then, you know, over the course of the next couple of months, he asked me if I wanted to help him open these restaurants and do like all the marketing and the planning and everything. And I kind of like asked for someone like him, you know, after I'd broken up with my past guy, he was like a bit younger, a bit immature. I was like, you know, I want someone older. I want someone like 30 that's got their head on their shoulders, that's like business savvy. And yeah, I don't know, like as he arrived, I was kind of like, this is interesting. So, but I was still focused on the business. I was like, just take it slow. So we were working on the restaurants. I was designing the logo for him, and he was showing me all these ingredients he got from Jamaica. And over time, I started to see like red flags with him, certain things in his home, photos on his laptop. And, you know, I think the last straw was like a marriage certificate with somebody else. And at this point, we were kind of like a bit romantic. I was spending a lot of time with him. So we were like, I was staying at his house. We were doing the business. It was kind of like that, like couple's goal vibes, you know, that every woman wants. Well, not every woman, but I did. Like, I was just like, I want that partner. Why not like put both of your energy into something if you're going to do something, right? Yeah. So I was thinking, okay, like this is going well. But yeah, I started to see these red flags, and eventually I say to him, look, this is like not working. I kind of already started to think about it a couple of weeks before I told him. And I just, yeah, I just draw the line on certain things, like being married to someone for a visa. Like, I was just like, yeah, no.
That you didn't know about.
That I didn't know about. And when I asked about it, he told me not to ask about it. And so I was like, yeah, that's, instantly I was just, I'm not going to be in this relationship. And yeah, like we can't talk about things, but yeah, that was just a little bit too big for me. So yeah, I had explained to him that I don't want to continue the relationship. And that's when he physically assaulted me and explained to me that, he was a fugitive, that he was on the run and that I wasn't going anywhere, because he'd spent too much time on me and invested too much energy into me. And I didn't quite understand it. But then it kind of, I started to connect the dots, because the things that I'd seen on his laptop indicated to me that he was some kind of pimp. And, you know, he was pimping girls and exploiting girls. So I didn't want to mention that to him, that I'd seen that stuff. So I just made it about, like, I just don't think this is going to work, you know. So at that point, being the person that he was and being so, he's not going to invest into anything and that, then let them just walk away. And I'd seen that after I'd spent more time with him and watched him with other people as well. Very, very money hungry person, do whatever it takes to get more money. So I, at that point, I didn't have a good connection with my family. I had put my foot down about, like, you know, addiction problems and stuff in my family. And I just, it was, I was suffering a lot from it. So being up in the Gold Coast, I was away from everybody. And he knew that. And he knew that I told him about my family. Obviously, I just disclosed everything. I'm a bit of an open book, you know, when it comes to, if I start to trust somebody. And of course, he put on the charismatic charm of like, oh my God, that's terrible. And after 2 months, of course, you know, we build a bond about that type of thing. But in his mind, he was just like, perfect, you know, perfect. This girl's away from her family. She hasn't even got a good relationship with them. And that's the type of women that these kind of guys want. Even though I had my shit together, he liked that. He liked that he used my car. He liked that I worked at the restaurant.
So it was all crafted. It was manipulative. It was planned. Yeah.
Oh, it was absolutely planned. And I guess I saw the signs, but it was just too late. And everything for him, it wasn't about the romantic side. Everything is about money. He wasn't trying to form a relationship with me. It was all purely what he was going to be able to get from me. And then if I was to stay with him for a long, long period of time, he would just get rid of me and replace me with somebody else. That's how it works, like in America specifically. So he wanted me to put my profile on escort websites, and I would, you know, see the guys, and then I would give him the money. And that's what he'd been doing for a very long time in America and then in Sydney. He was pushing girls through the massage parlors in Sydney. So they'd go there, make their money and come back to him. He didn't feel like he was doing anything wrong, because he was like, I'm your security. And this is how it works in America. Like, the pimps are the security. They look after the girls. So you give them all the money and they look after you. And they give you money if you need things, and maybe they'll like splurge on you with your own money, you know? So it's a weird dynamic.
It's a real control.
Yeah. It's strange. And like when I just started to learn about it, he was trying to convince me nothing was wrong with that. And I was just a waitress. So he was saving me from my shitty life that I had. And I started doing what he wanted me to do. The whole idea was not to have sex with people. He didn't want me to, because he had built like a connection with me, like not with the other girls that he'd been with, but with me. He didn't want me to do certain things, which was extremely difficult because when you go and see a guy and that's what they want, he puts me in a very awkward situation, you know. So he'd be telling me to like get money up front and then basically tell the guy that they're not going to get anything, that it was just companion visit. So a guy would give me like sometimes $2,000 and then I'd have to tell him that, yeah, that doesn't include anything else. So he put me in a very, very awkward position. And I'm all about customer service. So I was like, sorry, I had to say that. But like, yeah, I was all, like, I felt like this is not right.
I'm ripping them off.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, of course, my customer service, hospitality mind. Like, sorry, like I can't, you know. So, but yeah, it was very, the more I did it, the more controlling he got. So if a client would book me again, he would sometimes beat me up because obviously I'd done something too good. If I spent more than, the guy would book for an hour, and if I spent more than 10 minutes in there, he'd be ringing me going, why are you, what are you taking so long for? So it was psychologically just horrible.
That's a mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I didn't want to like be there in the first place and then to have him tell me that I'm enjoying it. Like I remember one time I was in a house and I turned around, like it was dark and he was like in the laundry. I don't know how he'd gotten in, but he was in like the laundry, like looking at us. And I just turned around and the guy didn't see him, but, and then he came out and then he told me, I saw you, you were enjoying that. So it was just constant like mind, like.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Just horrible. To be in a position that I clearly didn't want to be in, but the way that they control you is by, yeah, just constantly trying to break you down, like mentally. And it worked. It worked, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Anyone, like you can be, I mean, before I went into that situation, like a few weeks earlier, one of the girls that was staying with me, I went and picked her up at her place because her boyfriend was beating her. And I walked in and I was just like, get your shit, like, let's go. That was me 3 weeks before I met him. So it's like I didn't have a problem standing up for myself. And yeah, but it doesn't matter when you have somebody that's that focused on like breaking you down. Mm. That's that, like their main goal.
Yeah, it's it sounds like you just get stuck. And you know, I think for lots of different people, probably can't, listening to this, like I'm getting quite emotional listening to it. But for anyone that's listening to it, you have probably other moments in your life where you can feel stuck like that. The other piece I'm assuming is you feel like you misunderstand yourself, because I'm sure there's lots of different stories that are going through your head. So how did that play out in terms of you're here now in such a good place and you're yeah, as you said, your energy's changed. Like what was the shift to move out of that? I don't know. I almost see it as like a mental dungeon or something. Like it's, yeah. How did you get out of that?
Well, I felt something inside of me saying like I had to ride it out with him. Like I could have, this is always the thing with victims, right? Why didn't you go to the police? Why didn't you just call somebody? Well, first of all, like he told me he knew people in the police and he told me what he would do to my family. He sent me a photo of my grandmother's house shortly after I said, I don't want to do it. And then I find out like the lawyer that got him his fake passport lived a street away from my grandmother. So it was just, that was really strange. So yes, they have every single tactic, because at the end of the day, you were just money to them. And if you leave, they're losing money. So I did what he asked, and eventually he ended up taking me to Dubai. I had to just tell my family that we were going there to look at restaurants. I knew how my family would retaliate. So I just didn't want shit to hit the fan, basically. I'd kind of gotten myself into it, and maybe it's a little bit of my personality. I was like, well, I'll just get myself out of it. You know, I don't want to involve anybody and anybody gets hurt. So we went to Dubai, and Dubai was like horrible. I mean, there's no, like they have escorting services there, which is really strange. But I had to go around to clubs and like fancy hotels and try and pick up people that way. And like, weirdly enough, in Dubai, outside the clubs at like 3 o'clock in the morning is just escorts. They look like normal girls, but they're just escorts, a lot of Russian escorts, and charging like $200 for the night. And I'd still be there like 3 or 4 o'clock waiting. Why haven't you got anyone? Well, I don't know. I'm charging like $1,000 an hour. And that's what he'd make me charge. So I'd be like, That's why. So it was horrible. I'd spend, there was another girl with me at the time in Dubai. She was from New Zealand. And yeah, we'd just go out together and he'd be out, like I'd come home and he'd be sleeping with somebody in the house, like a new girl. And that would, it was like, I didn't care, like obviously about him and like my relationship, but it's this weird feeling you get, obviously, like I'm out working. And then it's like, what am I in? It's just so weird. Like I'm jealous of this girl being in my house, but I don't actually want to be here. Like you can have him if you want. So yeah, I'd call my family occasionally. And then as soon as I'd shut the laptop, I'd just burst out crying. And he'd be like, what are you crying for? Like you've got a lame life back in Australia. Like this is way better. So I'd just be like, all right. So we stayed in Dubai. I actually became like a resident there because he set up the business there to, I don't know, continue his, I guess, money laundering. That's what he wanted to do. So we left Dubai and took me to Miami. And, you know, before we left Dubai, he was like, you know, if anything happens going into Miami, like promise me like you'll stand by my side. I was like, yeah, sure. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So we got into Miami and I had to start. He's like, oh, you know, I don't want you working in Miami. I want us to do the restaurants, like just always promising. And I was like, I don't care. Like, I don't want to do the restaurant with you anyway. He's like, it's okay. But look, you know, why don't you do a bit of dancing, go to a strip club and do a bit of dancing. Like I never stepped foot in a strip club before. So I had to go and audition at a strip club. Never even been in one. Extremely awkward. They let me work there without, you know, even having my social security. I was hoping they would say no. They didn't. They let me work there. And then I was dancing there. I was really like, I weigh like maybe 60 kilos now. I think I was getting close to like 50. Yeah. I was working a lot, but more just, I'd be at the clubs and there was just no sleeping with him. Like, you know, I get back into bed and then the phone would ring. Okay, let's go. Whack your makeup on, like, let's go. It's money. Come on, let's go get money. I'm just like, I like money, but not that much. You know, like my sleep too. So he was recruiting girls in Miami. And then that's how I saw how the whole pimp game worked over there. And the girls don't mind it. The girls like having somebody to look after them and made it hard for me because I was the rebellious one. And but he was very violent and, you know, I guess he used violence, but also like the psychological coercion of, you know, oh, there's money missing. Like, did you steal it? But like, no, like I was such a good girl in that respect. The US girls don't give a shit. Like they'll steal all your crap and run. And he didn't care. Like he didn't care that they ran away. He was just like, that's not going to happen with you, you know. He said, I'll go to jail for your blood. That was the phrase he said to me. And I thought he was actually in the Bloods gang because he had a lot of paraphernalia to associate, and that's what he told me he was in. And so we were in Miami and I was working and then I had to renew my visa. So I convinced him to let me come back to Sydney, but in the meantime he was trying to get me a fake passport from Canada. And eventually he said, okay, you can go back to Sydney, but I'm going to send somebody with you. And so he sent a girl with me. But when we got to Sydney airport, I got interrogated like terribly. Like they treated me like a piece of crap, actually, because they found, you know, a lot of phones. Because what he'd do is set up profiles and the girls would run off, but he'd keep the profile running. And then I would show up, which was some guys like, what? You're not like blonde or whatever or brunette. That's how obsessed he was about, you know, keeping the money, getting the money rolling in. So yeah, I got back. I had a lot of phones on me and different things. And they're like, okay, well, that's fine. Like you want to do that. That's like the people at Sydney Airport. But this girl's not staying. Like she's clearly coming here to, you know, for those reasons. So they sent her back and he was like, oh, you know, you did that. You got her sent back so that you could, you know, do your thing in Sydney. I just kept playing the game. So obviously I came back, saw my family. It wasn't good. Like they could see something was wrong.
And were you able to be honest?
Well, it actually, yeah, it came up, but then I told them that I wanted to do it because I thought that would be the easiest way for them to just like let him be, because I was so petrified of him and what the consequences would be. Obviously, over this time, he'd got me so psychologically in fear of him. And I had other girls come, like they'd go and then they'd come back and they'd say, you don't want to mess with him. Like, you know, in Sydney, he like made a girl sit in the shower under hot water for like 2 hours, or like they were just telling me all these stories. So it wasn't just him telling me, it was these girls that had run away and that he'd got to come back through fear. So I was like, okay, I don't want to involve my family. If I go tell my family now what's happened, I mean, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. The men in my family are going to retaliate and be like, you know, of course, they're not going to go to the police. They're going to like go do something themselves. So I was like, I won't live with myself if something happens to them. So I said, I wanted to do it. He was looking after me. That just killed me, but I went along with it. And I ended up like running off to Melbourne because like it was just too overwhelming. My family were like, what? Like, what the hell's going on? I rang him and I was just like, oh my God, like my family suspects something's happening and everything. He's like, oh, don't worry, I'll look after you. Like, just go to Melbourne, go dance in Melbourne, you know. And I was like, yes, no problem. Anyway, I went to Melbourne because I had to get my visa. So I wanted to just pretend like I was like, it's done now. Like, this is all going to end now. But I had to just like keep going through the process. So I went to the embassy. They denied my visa. I was like, perfect. So I told him it's been denied. He's like, I don't care. I want you to try again. Had to wait like another 3 weeks and then went another time. And they were like, oh, can you just wait here? And they came back with an AFP officer and a special agent from the FBI in America. And at that point, I was just, again, like scared. I didn't feel like I was like saved. I was just like, oh my God, like I don't want to tell them anything. So they sat down with me and it took them like 2 hours to kind of, I guess, get me to break. Not because I was trying to protect him at all, but I was just like, can we just keep this quiet? Like, can we just like...
You're trying to protect yourself.
Yeah, I'd already like spent this time with him and like not run off to the police and kind of like not, you know, implicated myself in the fact that like I dobbed on him per se. And I didn't know, I didn't really trust the police. I watched a lot of crime shows. I feel like the police can sometimes just retaliate or do their thing without protecting the witness. So I was like, I didn't trust them in that respect. I wasn't getting that vibe from them. So I eventually told them, well, they told me that this is not his real name. This is not his real age. You know, he's not an American citizen. He got deported for a robbery in New York. And that's why he was saying when I came back to Miami, if anything happens, because he came back on a fake name.
Mm.
Yeah. And he was just, I guess, scared because that's the first time that he re-entered the States after he got deported.
So at this point, you're joining all the dots from the past.
Yeah. And so I was just like, okay, this is crazy. Like he wasn't 30, he was 35. And yeah, so they're like, we've been trying to catch up with this guy for like a long time, like the last 10 years he's been doing this. And he just kept going under fake names, so they couldn't catch him. And so they're like, we need your help. Like, and at that point I was just like, I can't, like, I can't, like, can I just go home? And I asked them, can you like give me a letter or something that I can show that like maybe I'm getting in trouble? Like you just caught me, like you haven't caught him. And they did one for me. They wrote a letter that said that I was going to get charged with like prostituting in the United States. And I sent that to him and he started crying. This big, barely 6 foot guy, like he started crying and saying, oh my God, I never meant for any of this to happen. Like, I'm so sorry. And I was like, it's okay. Like, I know, like just playing the game. Like, I know it's okay. I just need to go home to my family. You know, I really care about you. And he's like, yeah, I know I care about you too. And obviously just trying to in damage control, like, holy shit. Now she's talking with the police. Now she realizes like everything. So I went back home and like tried to rebuild my life. And like the first 6 months was great. I was just free and partying and having a good time. But then like everything came crashing down, obviously, because reality
catches up.
Yeah. Like I had to face like, you know, you go through trauma, you can't just expect it to just go away. It's got to come up, it's got to be processed. And yeah, I was in like a stress state like for so long. So yeah, so all of it started to come up. But weirdly enough, like I agreed to help them. They had like a female officer from the AFP come to me and they were like, do you want to help now? And I was just like, they were like, he's with another girl like in New York and she's got a baby with him. And I was just like, okay, I'll do it. So then, yeah, from that point, everything moved really quickly. They got like attorneys and Homeland Security to come out from America and sit with me. I told them the whole story. And then they said, okay, that was in like August. And they said, well, hopefully by Christmas, we have like a Christmas present for you. And I was just like, okay. And they did, just like a little bit before Christmas. I got a message from them saying they'd arrested him in New York. And at that point I was even more petrified. You think I would have been happy, but I was like, what happens if they don't get him like on enough charges or like he knows it's me now.
Yeah.
So they said like, we need you to fly over there and testify. And honestly, I don't know how I did it. Well, I did get there and end up in hospital on the first day because I was so stressed and just so petrified of seeing him. I hadn't seen him. It had been about a year and a half at that point. Yeah.
It's very brave.
Yeah. Everyone told me I was stupid. Maybe not everyone, like most of my family told me that I was stupid. I'm sure that they wanted me to do it. Like they wanted him locked up, but they didn't want me to go and do that. I'm sure it was like obviously a little bit of protection. But at the same time, I was like, I don't know. I just had to have faith that I was meant to meet him for a reason and it was meant to end with me.
So 27 years.
So, yeah. So he got convicted 27 years, 40 charges. You know, he took myself and other girls to different states, so like to Texas. So that was like 5 years. Every time he crossed the border, you know, into another state with us was like another 5 years. When he came back into America after being deported, that was like 10 years. So, yeah. And then a lot of other little things like fake passport and obviously just a lot of terrible things that he did. So, yeah, I went there as a witness and saw him and he couldn't even look at me, which was really interesting. Yeah, so the tables had really turned at that point, even though I was still really petrified to see him. I mean, his whole defense was that I ran this prostitution ring. Little old me, like I ran it. And he tried to play it like that because he asked me to do things like do spreadsheets or, you know, he wanted me to run it. And I guess he always thought if he gets caught, that will be his defense.
He always had a plan.
He tried to not get his hands dirty. Yeah. And, I could never hand him money and I always have to put it in a bag. So he was very well versed in how to do this and not be implicated at the end. That didn't work out very well for him though. He had a really bad lawyer and his lawyer went a little bit too hard on us as witnesses and the jury did not like that. They were actually crying, like bursting out in tears with the way that he was speaking to us and degrading us and making us explain sex acts that we did and certain things like that. It was just, it was vulgar, you know, and it didn't help his defense. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. So 27 years.
I think for anyone listening to this, like you can't help but just, you know, feeling there's so many emotions that go through as a person listening that, you know, it's, you know, you want to fight for you, you want to understand you, you want to try and work out, you know, how would you get out of it? What, you know, there's all these sort of stories that are going on in your head. But, you know, the one thing I am curious about, which would be lovely for people to hear is, you know, when there sounded like moments where it felt like you were helpless and there were like moments where you felt courage and you found something in yourself to overcome it all. Like when did you notice that courage kick in?
Well, I've always had that within me. I think that like going through this experience, I do sympathize with women that are in domestic violence situations because I think they're viewed as weak and are vulnerable and they can't help themselves. But often these men go after strong women with a head on their shoulders, and maybe it's more challenging for them to see them break down like a strong woman. Well, they want the strong woman at the beginning, but then they don't like the fact that you talk back or you have your own mind. I guess through all of it, I had in the back of my mind that I was going to end. I did really feel that. And if I hadn't have stayed with him as long as I did, he wouldn't have got 27 years. He would have got on maybe a passport, like fake passport charge or something like that. So I don't know, like I kind of do look at destiny sometimes and the way things have played out in my life. And I sometimes just, it does help to look at it like that rather than, you know, saying, oh, why didn't I get out sooner? Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's locked up. So yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I was having a conversation with someone this morning about this idea of sunk cost, right? Which is, you know, all these things had gone not to plan.
Of what?
Sunk cost. Sunk cost. You've spent all this time and energy on something that wasn't as lucrative or as good as it could have been.
Yeah.
And easy to say that when you're attached to all that history. But I wonder, you know, you're definitely in a place now where you're building a business, you've done some amazing things, you've put a lot of that behind you, but it's still part of your story. Mm-hmm. What about that time? It's not completely sunk. There's a lot in that you've got a lot of value from. There's a lot of your story that's inspiring other women. You know, Taryn has introduced you to me purely because she said to me, Brad, this is an inspirational person, not just a story, a person. Mm-hmm. So what about you as a person has changed that's stronger as a result of your story?
Well, I mean, I could not let that happen to me and then let that be my story. That's the girl that got trafficked. And I just thought, oh my God, what kind of story is that going to be if I don't heal through this? I mean, admittedly, like him getting locked up for 27 years, that was really, like we talk about closure, like that really did help. Mm-hmm. So once like that kind of ended and I started to rebuild my life, I met my partner who I'm with now. I've been with him for nearly 7 years. And I don't know, my healing really started when I was with him. Yes, around the US stuff, but not so much around that, but rather than my childhood and growing up and not feeling heard and not feeling like I fit in, feeling like a fish out of water in my own family, mm-hmm. you know, talking about serious topics and people not wanting to talk about it, feeling crazy almost because everyone around you is just kind of like, shut up, like, let's just get on with life. And you're just like, this is not right, you know? So, I started, talking with him about different topics and people that I like Dr. Joe Dispenza, Peter Krohn, you know, people like that. So we shared that in common for the first 3 years. You know, obviously it was a long honeymoon period, partied a lot, had a lot of fun together. Yeah. And then again, like, you know, reality sinks in and you go, okay, like, what am I doing with myself? And then before my 33rd birthday, I don't know, so, like the day before I was like, I felt like a heaviness of like stuff that I just, conversations that I hadn't had, things that I hadn't addressed. And so I started with the day before my 33rd birthday, which happened to be a few months into COVID. I wanted to confront someone that had sexually abused me. And that really started, I guess, a domino effect and started my real healing journey, yeah, which I wasn't like, I guess I knew it was coming. I guess I prolonged it because I'd known this for a while about this person, but I had brought it up and I had discussed it with different people close to me. No one had done anything to help me about it. It was just like, oh, well, this happens. This happens to women. Like it happened to me. And it's like, okay, cool.
There's not a lot in that, right? There's not a lot you get out of that happens, right? So you went in and confronted it, you know, and going back to the word we used before, bravery, courage, right?
Yeah.
That takes a lot of courage.
Yeah.
What has that provided in terms of healing?
Well, for me, if you don't face those demons, they will pop up, like their head will pop up later down the track. And for me, Vixen Fox has been something that's helped me to liberate me and heal, funnily enough. And maybe I just knew that by starting the brand that it would keep me accountable because I knew that I can't do these podcasts. I can't get on my website and tell my story if I don't do those hard things. Yeah. I don't like to be a hypocrite. No one does, but I particularly don't like being a hypocrite. I grew up around a lot of that and people saying one thing and doing another. And I just like, I don't want to be that person. So going over to the States and dealing what I had to do there was a big part of me going, I want to tell a different story one day. And then confronting the person that sexually abused me, who I was actually very close with, it was like the hardest thing that I had to do. And I thought, if I do this, first of all, I'm going to start healing. It was I'm going to give your shit back to you. This is not mine to carry anymore. And I carried it because I was like, that person's not strong enough to hear what I'm going to say. And the people around me at that time weren't ready to hear it either. And what actually ended up happening was people didn't believe me. And there's something called cognitive dissonance where it's just too much for somebody to process. And for me, I got to a point where I was like, I don't give a shit if you can't process it because I'm going to process it and I'm going to give that back to you. And so I can start to let in other things in my life because as long as you're carrying that stuff, you don't have space for all the things that you want, all the abundance, the beautiful relationship. And it does make me sad that, and this is why, again, I'm bringing that courage because I want to show women that they don't have to be ashamed of what happened to them being sexually abused. It does take something from you. It affected me growing up and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I would go into relationships and be a little bit promiscuous. And I mean, I had 3 long-term relationships, but I was always needy, like needed that guy. And I didn't know what was wrong with me and got shamed by people around me for being like that. And I look back now and I think like I was abused and and it changes you in a way. So it brought me to this point. And honestly, I think about all the women that I don't even know yet that they would hear this and be like, I don't have to carry that either. I'm not saying you have to go and confront who sexually abused you or who did you wrong. It doesn't even have to be sexual abuse. But what ends up happening is that it takes a piece of you and then you carry on through life not living up to your true potential because of something someone else did. So what I started to realize after that is I learned the term emotional independence. I'd never heard of it before. Obviously, I heard the words individually, but I heard that. And then I started to realize, which was very confronting, that I'm causing my own suffering.
Takes a lot of ownership to even think like that.
I didn't want to accept it because I was like, it's not my fault. It's not my fault those things happened to me. But what was happening and what's happened my whole life is I've waited for an apology. I've waited for someone to say they understand me. And after I, you know, let the cat out of the bag with being sexually abused, it was incredible the people that didn't support me that I thought that they would. And at that point I went into victim mode. And I just remember like getting physical pain in my body, my lower back, my hips. And I went to chiropractors, I went to do all sorts of things. But what I guess the reason that I've been able to move forward is that I've done my research, and I started to research what's happening in my body. So the psoas muscle is responsible for fight or flight. So when you're ready to run, it activates. So as that gets tighter, it affects the lower back because that's where it's connected to. But you think, I have lower back pain, I've got to go see a chiro. But you just realize you're activating your fight or flight
and
response.
It's just always on.
It's always on. And even still, I have trouble with my hips. It's where I hold my stress. It's where I tense up. But now I'm becoming way more conscious of it. So, starting to learn about my body and starting to, release what is holding me back and try and process those type of things has helped me to get to where I am.
It's, as I say, there's a lot to digest for anyone listening to this, but you use that word emotional independence and you know, that in that story you talked about people expecting them to support you and they didn't. And, often we see a lot of stages in anyone's life, you know, where things that you expect don't happen, and it, mm-hmm. and it creates this moment of truth for you where, like you said, the victim mode or the way you deal with it. And there's in most cases, there's justifiable reasons to be the victim.
Right.
It's very justifiable from my experiences, from all sorts of stories. When you look at emotional independence, what does it mean, and what do you get from emotional independence?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it made me feel so liberated when I realized that I had the power to control how I think, act, and feel. And it's those three things that make up your personality. So once I started to realize that nothing was happening to me physically, I wasn't getting emotionally abused anymore. No one was texting me or calling me or harassing me. And I accepted I'm causing my own suffering. Second thing is that I realized that I didn't love myself as much as I thought I did. I didn't have high self-worth as much as I thought I did. And without that, it's really hard to go through the healing because it requires a lot of self-love, mm-hmm. a lot of positive self-talk.
Yeah, a belief in yourself.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I started to like look at this emotional independence, and I started to get excited because I was just like, wow, if I can like overcome this, if I can basically not require anyone to love me, respect me, apologize to me, understand me, I'm solely responsible for loving myself, respecting myself, understanding myself. It's a work in progress. Like I still, you know, just from the way I grew up, still feel like you need validation from people, and it's nice to have that. But my number one goal is to get so emotionally independent that you don't require that. And then it's hard to shake you. And honestly, I feel like it's the number one skill that an entrepreneur can learn, because there's so many things that can trigger us. But I just started to look at these triggers as like someone says something about you and it affects you. Well, how do you feel about yourself? Like, why did that affect you? Like if someone says you're ugly and you don't feel like you're ugly, it's not going to affect you. You're going to laugh at them. But if you feel like you're ugly and that person says it, it just adds to how you feel about yourself. So it's a lot of self-reflection, a very, very high level of self-awareness. And then you just start to iterate and you start to go, catching your unconscious thoughts, because that's what's controlling you. Like our unconscious program with all our thoughts and beliefs and all these things from the past, right? Might not even be your voice. Could be things that people said to you, but it's just playing out as, oh, that's my thought about myself. I grew up around a lot of anxiety and depression and medication and substance abuse. And I honestly just thought that's how I'm going to be too. Maybe not the substance abuse side of things, but more like I'm just going to be an anxious person. This is just who I am. But, you know, the phrase PTSD, you can actually look at it as PTSA, which is post-traumatic stress adaptation. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, and this is what helped me heal, I guess, like myself. I didn't go to counselors and take medication, because once you start to look at yourself objectively, you understand the body is just doing what it's meant to do to keep you in survival.
Survival, yeah.
So that thing happened to me. I adapted. I became a shy person, for example. I'm just a shy person, or I don't like to go into relationships, or, and then you go, that's me. But it was just an adaptation. But if you can't pick up on that, that's just going to play out for the rest of your life, and you're going to say, I always choose guys that are abusive or certain things. But a lot of the focus is on the other person. And that's what I was doing. I was trying to fix my family. I was like certain people in my family. I was trying to fix them. And once they're fixed, I'll feel better.
There's so much in this. I wonder with where you're at the moment, you know, you talked about being unshakable or striving for that. And we know that things are going to pop up all the time that will remind us of those things, or maybe just challenge us.
Yeah.
And in the entrepreneur's journey, that will happen. You know, the people that won't like you. What are the things that you now know about yourself that you're going to watch out for in your journey ahead, that you look out for and you say, oh, I know that's my thing, and I'm going to watch it?
There's triggers all the time. The goal is not to get rid of the triggers and make your life just seamless and like happy. The goal is emotional resilience, emotional independence. The one thing I learned especially from Joe Dispenza. He's a quantum physicist. If people haven't heard about him, he's kind of getting a bit bigger now. Mm-hmm. But the thought feeling loop. So what happens is we have a thought, someone triggers us in some way, we have a thought, and then it triggers, you know, it releases chemicals to the body, and then that's an emotion, what we call an emotion. And then what happens is you create a thought equal to that emotion.
Mm.
And on the loop goes, and we've all experienced that, you know, you, I don't know, a bit of road rage and someone like flips you off, and then you get that, angry, and then you have a thought, and then it's finished. The incident's finished, but you keep driving, and then you say, oh, you know, I've just had the crappiest day ever. Mm. And then you get another feeling, and then you get home, and then you start arguing with your partner, and you haven't caught that thought feeling loop because nothing's actually happening anymore. Mm. So I guess my goal always is to catch that thought feeling loop and realize when I'm feeding it.
Mm.
And you can starve it, and you can shorten the refractory period of that emotion. So of course you're going to get triggered, but the goal is, yeah, not to like hide away in your own little bubble. It's to put yourself into situations because someone's going to trigger you, and then that's where you're going to see where you're not free.
Mm.
And Peter Crone says this. He's also known as the mind architect. He talks about there's people, situations, and circumstances will show you where you're not free. So you take notice of that, and then you say, wow, okay, that person really triggered me. I went off for like 2 hours. Like I was in that state for 2 hours. So you don't judge it. You just like let it be, and you just say, okay, that's interesting that that person said this, and like I just went on a total like thought feeling loop for like hours. Then the next day, you know, it's your next challenge. How can I shorten that? And why did it go on for 2 hours? Oh, that's right, because I feel like really insecure about myself. I feel really insecure about the way I look. Or it's not about them. The best thing you can do is make it all about you. And that's confronting because you're like, it's not about me. That person. And then you start to realize how ridiculous it is that someone can change your emotional state. And like you can go home and start arguing with your partner because some random in the traffic like cut you off. It's kind of crazy.
It's so true. And I'm so grateful you're talking about this because, you know, I go through this. Everyone goes through this. You know, it's and every moment where you go through growth is often where you looked at yourself. And there are no doubt there's circumstances outside of you that you don't like or that weren't ideal or that were sometimes unfair as well. And there's been a lot of unfairness in your world. So it's not a judgment of how unfair it is or what, you know, what's good and bad. It's just how you deal with it. And I think there's a lot of value in saying that you have agency and control in your life. And I think that's what I've just taken out of the last sort of 30 minutes of you unpacking and talking about that is that it really inspires me or inspires anyone listening to this that you can take something, you can take control. And it may not be easy. But what's the alternative?
Absolutely. That's always on my mind. Like, what's the alternative? Like, you kind of watch people suffering. And unfortunately, it's just kind of anxiety and depression and financial hardship and relationship problems are just the norm. And like, I'm aiming for it not to be the norm.
Mm.
So easy to just, oh, yeah, my life's horrible too. Oh, yeah, this person. It's actually hard. Once you start to wake up, your circle gets a lot smaller.
Mm.
So don't be surprised if people start to fall away from you as you start to grow. And honestly, I think I knew that. And once I finally put my foot down, a lot of people fell away and it was extremely uncomfortable to have all those conversations. But I started thriving after that. And some of them were my family. And I think people should know that you don't have to stay in a situation with a family member or somebody that you've been friends with for 20 years. You have to take it really seriously like that because unfortunately you lose a part of yourself staying in that situation when you know that that person doesn't share the same values as you do, or for me, like didn't believe something so traumatic happened to me. I just quit. That was like, that's where I drew the line.
Yeah. And lots of people can have that that story in their head of blood's thicker than water, right? And this attachment to being in a family situation that's not healthy because it's supposed to be something you're loyal to.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, especially when your parents, like, look after you. I mean, that was the harder thing for me. My parents weren't abusive to me. Like, I mean, I felt maybe emotionally abused, I guess. They didn't really know they were doing it, but went to private schools, had, you know, Christmases, had a lot of great memories. So it was really, really difficult for me to say, I can't go on like this, you know. I'm here if you need. I poured a lot of, like, effort trying to help them. But now I understand that healing is not a easy journey, and it requires a lot of confidence, like, in yourself, like, self-belief to start with. And what I notice with certain people in my family is that they couldn't even get to that point. Like, the self-worth wasn't there. So, of course, you're going to sabotage yourself, and you're not going to live up to your full potential. But I kind of had to say, like, I'm going to do it for them. As much as, like, I felt hurt by people in my family, I got to the point where I'm like, I'm not helping anybody by staying in this, like, sinking boat. Like, and that's hard.
And this is the beauty of your story, which is the beauty of you being here today. You're playing a bigger game, right?
Yeah.
And I think to respect all of the different phases of your journey, that's the theme that's emerging, right? And I suppose what, you know, to help us finish our conversation off, you are playing a bigger game with your business. And I know part of your alignment has been to, you know, Freedom Hub and other bodies that are really dealing with and tackling and doing their best to support, you know, people that are vulnerable in your situation or similar situations to what you've been in from an abuse perspective. But what are you hoping for the future? If you think about that bigger game, you know, what are you hoping the impact is through your brand and through the conversation you're having out there?
Yeah, well, like I said, I wanted to have my business always, and I started off very much like I need to go and help all the women in the world. Naturally, when you come out of that, you just kind of want to help. But then I realized I want to be more than my story. I don't want to, you know, be a charity and tell my story and have people go, oh, poor her, like, let me buy something from her. So I started to create a brand that I'm really proud of. You know, there hasn't been a lingerie brand come out of Australia in 16 years since another brand. So I kind of looked at that space and I realized that this is where I want to go. I always choose, like, the hardest possible thing. Like, lingerie is, like, literally one of the hardest things that you can do, and that's why it's taken me so long. But I went, you know what, I want to go the road less traveled. I want to do something that not everybody's doing. I didn't want to do athletic wear or swimwear. There's a lot of those brands.
I was going to say, it's a pretty crowded market too.
They just keep coming, you know. So I couldn't be creative enough with that. So yeah, I wanted to do the brand, and I want to do it really well. Mm. And I want Vixen and Fox to be a leader, like, in the lingerie market for, you know, luxury lingerie. And I guess that's, like, first and foremost, but obviously my story is, like, a big part of it. And, like, only now I'm able to, I guess, articulate it better and figure out, like, how it fits with the brand, because, you know, you've got lingerie and then you've got, like, this trafficking story, and you're just, like, even for anyone else looking at it, it's just obviously quite morbid talking about that situation, and how does it link to lingerie? So that was, I struggled with that for a long time. And even people that I consulted with were like, I don't know, like, this is it's a lot to unpack. And that's why it's taken many years, because I've had to get to a point where I'm like, okay, how are we going to put this out there, and how is it going to help women? So, you know, I chose lingerie obviously to connect with my sexuality again in a positive way, and to connect with my feminine, because when you go through a lot of trauma, you disconnect from that feminine part of you. And so it's helped me to connect with my feminine again. It's helped to liberate me. It's absolutely kept me accountable on my healing journey, because I feel like I'm got this responsibility to a lot of women that I don't even know yet. It's weird. I don't know. It's like an innate feeling that I know that this is going to help a lot of women. But again, I wanted to create a product that reminds them of that, and not only just some product that I just whipped together. I mean, it takes us 12 months to do one collection. Like, everything is very intentional. A lot of, like, beautiful intention goes behind the designs and choosing out all the fabrics. And that's an extension of me. That's just how I am in my personal life. I like a lot of intention behind what I do. And the story is there, and not everybody is maybe going to resonate with, you know, being trafficked, but that's not, I don't want to talk about how to not be trafficked and how to recover from trafficking. It all comes back to just whatever's holding you back. It could have been the smallest thing. You could have got bullied in school for just a short time and suddenly, like, you just lost yourself and you don't know who you are. Going through my story and going through my journey of the things that I've been through, it could be trafficking, it could be sexual abuse, it could be bullying, it could be anything. But the point is that something could be holding you back. And this product, being lingerie, I want it to liberate women from whatever it is that is holding them back. Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I hear in that, I hear this, that connection to self-belief. I hear the connection to, you know, trusting yourself, you know, believing in yourself. And that's what, you know, really came out of your story, you know, to me when I listen. And that seems to be the upside of the trauma that anyone goes through, is if you lean into it, that's what, you know, you're talking about. And I suppose that's the essence of your brand from my read, from what you're telling me. But I'm really excited about the future for you, and I'm really, really, really privileged to have you here today, mate. So
thank you so much, Brad.
No problem. Probably my only final thing is a little bit more business related, but if we are going to see you out and about, your product, I know that there's some stuff all over the world, there's discussions, but where might be the most likely place we can see Vixen and Fox?
Well, you can always visit our website.
Mm-hmm.
So that's www.vixenandfox.com.au. If you happen to be in Paris, we're stocked in Paris now,
mm-hmm.
In Brigade Mondaine. We're in talks to be stocked in Melbourne. So, yeah, we have got a very strong wholesale strategy at the moment. So we just want to get in stores. We want people to be able to go and see the product for themselves. So, yeah, but you can follow us on Instagram as well, _VixenandFox. So join us there. We, you know, not only are we putting out content around lingerie, but we've got VNF stories. So we're interviewing inspirational women about their journey. And that's the type of content I want to put out there, and, you know, just really empowering stuff that is tangible, that you can have a takeaway, and you know, you're joining a community that's more than just talking about lingerie.
I love it. I love it. Well, I hope you absolutely smash it.
Thank you so much, Brad.
You're a legend, Kay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll let you go now.
Thank you.